I'm John Batten, and some of you might know me from my art hat or my heritage hat. And I'm very happy to introduce Mark Brody, the president of the US-China Environmental Fund, whose current project is Panda Mountain. And Mark is very kindly going to give a wide-ranging talk about some of the issues, including a nature reserve that comprises pandas, but also comprises indigenous Tibetan people. And I think Mark's comments will be quite interesting, because he will explain that the Hong Kong government has or is pumping a sizable amount of money into the Sichuan province reconstruction after the earthquake, but these funds are going into some useful areas, such as more roads and more buildings. It's the sort of similar problem we have in Hong Kong, as you all know, where government here spends vast amounts of money on infrastructure projects. Anyway, I'd like to introduce Mark, and I hope you can give him a warm welcome. Thank you.
So I'm going to try to get through the talk relatively quickly, so hopefully we can have a bit of an exchange and I can address some of your questions. The context of this talk, as John has mentioned, is the Wulong Nature Reserve is very, very close to the epicenter of the 5/12 or May 12th earthquake, and at this time, as part of a national or state level program in China, provinces throughout China, in this case the Hong Kong HKSAR government, has essentially adopted the Wulong Nature Reserve and is providing nearly 1.5 billion Hong Kong dollars to a comprehensive set of reconstruction projects that's very far ranging. And certainly these funds will provide lasting benefit to the reserve in terms of infrastructure. This talk is just looking at some of the challenges that are not yet addressed or unmet challenges and ways in which some modest changes could qualitatively improve or maintain the distinctive World Heritage character of the Wulong Nature Reserve. And so presently, actually starting next Monday, a international delegation will begin a site visits in Sichuan province looking at the World Heritage status of Wulong and the surrounded protected areas, because in July 2006, Wulong and its surrounding area was declared a World Heritage Site, the Sichuan Giant Panda Sanctuary. And so now, typically 3 years after a World Heritage Site inscription, there is a mandatory review. Well, that three-year review was delayed for a year, and so that three-year review on World Heritage Site status is taking place this April, and a report will be prepared in May and June and then presented to the World Heritage Council in July. So I'm going to try to move rather quickly, just share some images and a little bit of context about Wulong. And the gentleman that gave this quote, I manage a nonprofit organization, environmental organization, United States, or here in Asia we would say an NGO. The gentleman here is one of the more renowned conservationists in the world. He is a senior advisor at National Geographic Society and someone that has given our NGO considerable support in providing letters of introduction to institutions that we work with. So in terms of today's talk, I'm mainly interested in how we can look towards stewardship And stewardship means the essentially the long-term management of resources that would constitute best practices and engage stakeholders. And so in this case, in Wulong, we don't want to have a dichotomy where one has to choose people versus pandas, or that hopefully the choice isn't reduced to either one is aiding people or aiding pandas. Hopefully we should be sophisticated enough and mindful enough that we could aid pandas and people concurrently as we move forward. The unique case for Wulong is it is the opportunity to have what would be one of the finer models of harmonious development in China, and that essentially is a combination of social, cultural, and economic practices that are essentially reinforcing one another. And it means that there's essentially a synergistic benefit among them. And the reason Wulong could achieve this, and it's not an easy thing to do, is because of its highly symbolic standing in China, in the world, because it has the most captive pandas. Pandas on loan here at Ocean Park. There's four pandas here at Ocean Park, all of which came from Wulong. So the bottom statement, to protect the panda, is to restore the balance between people and nature. That was one of the themes that we developed to help the Wulong Panda Center in terms of its interpretive theme or message to the visitors in the reserve. So we've touched upon the support that's come from Hong Kong. These are just some of the press release photos that one might find on the Development Bureau's website that shows milestones when there were agreements signed with Sichuan Province, or there was actions taken by LegCo in terms of approving significant funding for Wulong. And so with this enormous support, we're hoping that this type of foundation or base of support would enable Wulong to maintain its high standards. So just as a context, Sichuan is that green outline here, the red dot, which is quite large in terms of scale, is essentially the zone that Wulong is in the center of Sichuan, not very far from Chengdu. I just want to point out the fascinating thing about pandas is that you will see here that this green area is agricultural China. Here's the Tibetan Plateau, here's the high plains of Qinghai in western China. And pandas, the distribution of pandas are right on a crescent, right at that transitional area between agricultural China and nomadic or kind of indigenous cultures to the west. And this is, again, these green areas here show different blocks of remaining panda habitat. The area circled is the Sichuan Giant Panda Sanctuary. It is the largest contiguous block of panda habitat still remaining in the world. I'll show one other thing that's just real interesting. If you look at this is the Great Sichuan Breadbasket. If you look at the angle of where agricultural China and the Tibetan Himalaya Plateau is, you'll see that there's this line here. That transitional line happens to be the fault line for the 512 earthquake. And so you can see, here's Chengdu, here's Dujiangyan. The epicenter, it's not perfect to scale, it's hard to see, but this epicenter is actually showing the earthquake to be in Guangdong. It was slightly south of Guangdong. But the epicenter was nearly contiguous to the eastern edge of the Wulong Nature Reserve. And this is showing the epicenter much closer to Wulong. Yin Shou is the national memorial site where there was a terrible loss of life. This is just showing the highways and the way in which one would access Wulong. This is the epicenter is right about where that red dot is. So I wanted to touch upon issues of cultural and natural heritage. This is taken, the document on the right is from the May 2006 evaluation report that was prepared by a partner organization to UNESCO. It's called the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. And the interesting thing about Wulong is that it is both a World Heritage Site and also an International Biosphere Reserve. And so that this logo here is MAB, is man in the biosphere. That is, that has a number of standings. This shows this outline in red that may be a little hard to see is the World Heritage Site. Wulong is the largest, maybe number six, Jiajian Mountain might be just as large, but it's essentially the center of the main heritage site, and the main highway goes through it. This is showing, again, the mountainous area where you can see agricultural China ending. That red dot is showing the epicenter right there. That's hopefully pretty accurate. And this is the area that I'll come back to later right here, where the road right up here in Gunga, because it's an interesting area because it's both where the Hong Kong government is financing the reconstruction of a new Panda Center. It's about 250 million Hong Kong dollars, that single facility. This is showing essentially in just relative terms that the size of Wulong, for those that may know the area, it's almost the size of Wulong itself is essentially equal to the entire Hong Kong territory. It's also the size of Wulong is almost the distance from Chengdu to Wulong itself. So here are some of the types of issues of concern to the IUCN. These were comments that were written in May 2006 before Wulong was approved to be a World Heritage Site. It talks about in a management plan, it emphasizes thematically in this section the notion of harmonious development, to be the human population should be harmonized with the national environment, the natural environment. It talks about cultural values. To me, one of the very enduring or endearing to me qualities of Wulong has been this cultural landscape where you see mountain villagers living on terraced fields as they have done for hundreds of years. It talks about one of the big criteria is landscape level planning, and it's talking about connectivity. Because the World Heritage Site is the largest piece of contiguous panda habitat left in this world, they're wanting to be sure that there is adequate provisions, that there's not further fragmentation. And it's talking about that there should be connectivity across vulnerable bottlenecks, and that when corridors have been encroached by logging or agricultural activities, there should be an active program of habitat restoration involving the planting of relevant native species, particularly those that improve panda habitat. So we've taken much of these recommendations to heart over the last few years. Our nonprofit, I serve as the senior advisor to Wulong for Conservation and Sustainable Development. And what's particularly meaningful to me is the IUCN, representing best practices in conservation, acknowledge that the local communities have a strong interest in conservation, and they would like to see them involved. They'd like to see support to have the local communities remain involved in conservation. And here it says, local communities should also be informed and involved where possible in the management of the property. That's a quote that I put into the flyer. And of all the issues, this is just a repeat, in terms of things that haven't yet been met, but may be able to be kind of the next wave of reconstruction work. These are areas where hopefully greater attention and emphasis can be given so that local communities have a way to play a meaningful part. So again, this is talking about the corridors. I should have jumped ahead. And again, that local people should be involved in the management of the property. So I'm just going to show some images of the reserve, talk about some specific activities that we're engaged with. This is a sense of those cultural landscapes that exist in the reserve, traditional buildings, use of indigenous building materials. Due to lighting, you can't see, but this is a certain type of farmhouse. There's a very distinctive indigenous architecture here, a type of vernacular, what we call mountain architecture. These are just some of the people that we've helped. The woman here works with our NGO. She provided donations and raised money to families. This is a grandmother. The parents died in the earthquake, so she provided funding to some of the orphans, and on a personal basis gave money. This gentleman's raising a, wearing a coat that her name is Lynn Hoops. She went and raised money to provide coats to families post-earthquake to be sure they got it. This is one of the cultural sites in the reserve. So these are a people that have learned to really make good on in very tough agricultural areas. And so that there is this very distinct cultural landscape. This is just a slide out of a Chinese PowerPoint. But what they have done during the reconstruction process is this area to the here is Yingshou. And so what they've said is basically to the west of Yingshou, we're going to make this Tibetan. And to the north of Yingshou, we're going to use Xiang style. And so Sichuan is in a period of massive tourism development. And they've come up with a program that, or an approach, so that visitors to the area now will see distinctive Tibetan areas and distinctive Xiang or different types of architecture areas. The challenge is the architectural style that's being used for much of the reconstruction was never present in Wulong prior to the earthquake. So it's rather unfortunate that you have external funding and tremendous reconstruction effort, but rather than reflecting indigenous or vernacular architecture, there's now, I hesitate to say, but more of a theme park approach where things have been simplified to the point so that Tibetan architecture is being used in an area where it never once existed. And so in terms of heritage values, it's quite different. This is just a couple of pictures to show the level of density. Wulong has very little level ground. It's a remarkably mountainous community. And so as part of the reconstruction effort, and as the title talks about, indigenous mountain communities are being settled along the river valley. There can be some advantages to that. Certainly there can be disadvantages. One of the things that is dramatic is the level of density here is hard to appreciate. When you have these scattered settlements where each family had, let's say, 3 to 4 mu of land, which would be approximately 2,500 to 3,000 square meters of farmland, a little better than, say, half an acre, two-thirds of an acre of, in terms of English standards or American standards. So instead of staying, keeping an association land as an agrarian farming community, most of the villagers are to be coming into these very large, dense settlements. And there's approximately about 10 of these now being constructed in the reserve. Again, the lighting's a little bit difficult, but this is showing just a view down a particular side street or corridor within these developments. So the other thing we want to talk about is this is the World Heritage Site again. One of the most important studies talks about connectivity. There were three areas that were identified as the most critical bottlenecks for panda conservation. The point of interest to us is here is Gung Da, the big town in the east, and this is one of the most critical connection points of maintaining connectivity. Again, it's a little bit hard to see, but if you follow this line, here's the road, comes like this. And so the river is starting in the west and it's flowing. The river flows downstream in the direction that I'm putting this cursor. And so because of the enormous steepness of the area, the only possible alternative to have a highway through the area is to follow that river bottom. It's just dramatically steep. There are a number of tunnels now to improve the highway conditions, but this shape here is very distinctive. You can pick it out on many maps. But this is showing the two main towns in Wulong are Shawan with about 2,000, Gung Da with about 2,000, where it says Wulong Panda Center. That was the pre-existing Panda Center. The new Panda Center, when you hear Wulong is moving, sometimes a lot of times they say Wulong is moving in the media. It's not accurate to say that. It's not Wulong that's moving. It's a panda facility is moving from central Wulong to eastern Wulong. So they're moving a captive panda facility that was here to a valley right there. And they're doing that because this is an area that can accommodate a lot more people. The slopes are not as severe. Access is easier. So the general safety of 80 or more pandas, 100 pandas, can be better provided in this area. And this is the largest single reconstruction project for Wulong's reconstruction. Again, about 250 million Hong Kong dollars, which is a tremendous sum. So what we want to just touch upon in terms of connectivity, this is an exotic species. This is a larch. It's not deciduous. It's a type of conifer tree. It's not deciduous, but it's very interesting. It turns brown, and then it will green up again. But what you see is this was after logging occurred in the reserve in the 50s and 60s. This was large. It's a Japanese larch. It was planted in many areas along the highway. It's around the new Panda Center and by agriculture. But what's important is there's no understory. The way this tree grows, all of the understory is lost, and so it becomes a monoculture. And so what we're looking at, this is a bigger view of an agricultural community. You can see these stands of the trees, this brownish-orangish tint. This is called Yusudong. This is where my son Nathan and I and some others, this is James Riley, the chair of the Royal Geographic Society here in Hong Kong. We were just camping a few days ago. This is looking down on the new Panda Center site, but just above it, you can again see the larch that has essentially no understory whatsoever. So for us, in terms of our thematic approach would be to provide employment for the local people. We're looking at a way in which they can be engaged in the management of the property by harvesting an exotic species, processing that wood, and then replacing that larch tree with native species and building back the diversity in these critical habitat areas. This is Mr. Fung, one of the native villagers that we're working with. This is Mr. Fung, his family. These happen to be granddaughters. But this is Mr. Fung's son and his wife. He is in a village in Long Tong Village, one of the villages that's being relocated. But the critical thing is his village and others adjacent to it are in that panda corridor that's been identified on the eastern side of Wulong. They're being asked to move down to a dense settlement in Gungda. They have yet to do so because there is no employment for them. So you'll see this is the Lama at the temple above Long Tong Village, above the Panda Center. We are working with this local Lama to improve a cultural program. So again, here's the main Panda Center will be constructed right here. This is the main site. And Long Tong Village is right here. Mr. Fung's farmhouse is right about here. And so this is the critical corridor area here that we're trying to rebuild where the larch is present. This is Mr. Fung's front yard, just in front of his home. This is a very fine gentleman that happens to be the village head for Long Tong. There's seven separate villages. He's the administrative head. He's taken the position that the people should not move down to the valley bottom until there's employment provided for them. This is a gentleman that's an advisor to our NGO, helping us develop a nursery program. This is a workshop that we've had recently looking at the larch trees and teaching the local farmers how to identify larch. Here's my son, Nathan. This is just downhill from Mr. Fung's front yard terrace. This is one of the native trees that he's planted on a terrace. You can barely make it out, but I have other pictures if people happen to be interested. There's a very dense housing development right there. And right here is some temporary earthquake housing. But many of the villages of Long Tong are to be situated here. This is not yet complete. It's still bricks. It hasn't yet been finished. This is beneath Mr. Fung's home, but this is again in Long Tong Village on one side of the... These are trees that were just planted around April 1st. So we're just starting a nursery property. We're working with local families. These happen to be two different species of magnolia tree. I just have a few, pretty pictures of Wulong to let you know what a magnificent place it is. And then I would just take some questions. So this is just showing, again, diversity of Wulong, the people and the pandas. These are from the heritage site. Wulong's a very diverse area due to its altitude changes, tremendous floral or botanical diversity, and has quite an important history in terms of its founding and administrative functions. And this is the leading panda center that was, this is the facility that is being moved within the nature reserve, the China Conservation Research Center for the giant panda. So I can entertain any questions about Sichuan reconstruction. We have been working, helping provide master plans and construction documents for specific facilities and training of Wulong personnel and those types of things.
Thanks, Mark. Do you want to sit back at the
sure.
table? Is that easier? I think all of us who live in Hong Kong were struck by the look of the new village that you showed us, the new settlement, which looked like a
yeah, but we can go way back to that.
A very Hong Kong New Territories village style.
Yeah, it's only three stories though. If it was about
oh no, Hong Kong's villages are three stories
oh,
too.
Oh, are they?
Yeah. Can I invite some questions? Yeah, please, in purple. We'll give you a microphone.
Hi, Debbie McGowan. You mentioned in one of your slides about the state goals for the Wulong Reserve, I presume.
Yes.
What are the goals broadly, and how well do they coincide with the World Heritage requirements?
I think Wulong's goals are focused principally on panda conservation. I do think that they are consistent in principle with the World Heritage objectives, but in practice, there is some disparity. And the differences come not in the panda conservation side, but the management integration of people into that part of the equation. So Wulong has a history of outstanding progress in animal husbandry or veterinary science. They have a remarkable program that has achieved surprising success in terms of panda breeding. Routinely, they have 15 or more baby pandas born in captivity. Virtually all of the pandas survive. They had a stretch of 4 years where they never lost, or 5 years where they never lost a panda baby. So they've been tremendously successful. I think their challenge now as a reserve is to broaden its mission and work more with habitat and more with the communities. And they've been extremely focused to date on that these panda centers, and that's where the greatest sum of money from the Hong Kong government is being spent. Is they're spending building two panda centers, one within the reserve and one in Dujongyan, which will become again about another 80 million Hong Kong dollars, or that's actually 80 million renminbi in the Dujongyan area for medical research on pandas.
And tourists will go there to look at pandas? Is that the idea?
Yes, I mean there's 2 points. One is the continuation of a strong panda breeding program. One is a magnet for tourism. And the other thing I might add, Wulong does have a unique distinction that it is beginning a panda reintroduction program. And so as the center within this World Heritage area with the largest contiguous panda habitat, they're looking to take pandas bred in captivity, pandas born in captivity, and then put them in very large natural enclosures and then release them to the wild. They had one failed project in 2006 where they released a young male, into a territory where there were quite a few other pandas, and he did not fare well against the larger and more mature male pandas. So they're now at the point where they're going to retool and start putting more pandas into the wild shortly after the reconstruction work is done. And they're moving a team right now. They'll be moving a team, presumably in the near future, to renew reintroduction activities.
I've seen pictures of Wulong after the earthquake, and destruction there was quite severe, which obviously is why they're moving it. What was the situation with the villages in the area, and did the government have much of an alternative in terms of trying to come up with a solution for housing in short order?
Well, there's a few parts to that question. Wulong had severe earth landslides along the main highway in the eastern section of the reserve. It was essentially sealed off. So access to Wulong for the first 6 months, 6 to 7 months after the earthquake, one had to travel a tremendous distance the long way around. You could not approach Wulong from the east. You had to go south around a mountain range and then to the west. So Wulong's greatest problem has been accessibility. In terms of damage to buildings within Wulong, a number of the village houses, and I would say the majority, actually remained intact. So the total number of houses that were affected in terms of villager houses would be less severe than many of the other communities that were along that diagonal from the southeast to the northwest, because Wulong's soil conditions are quite different. But it's not a river bottom. It has a river bottom, but it's not like the main river bottom that had very undulating soils, so that you had some communities where the whole buildings were just throwing up and down because the land was rolling so much. So the total destruction of Wulong's residential housings wasn't that severe, but the infrastructure was knocked out. Water was knocked out. Electricity was knocked out. So people did, for a period, concentrate in temporary earthquake housing to have certain infrastructure. But by the summer of, or even spring of 2009, a year ago, they've, by and large, many of them moved back to their previous housing. So, and now they're summer in the transition of either leaving their housing and to go to new housing. I don't know if I'm answering your question, but it wasn't as dire. It was a very difficult time initially, but for many people, they would choose to stay in their own house.
Are you saying then that the resettlement is entirely due to the tourism objectives of the resort?
No, I don't think that at all. And again, it's not for me to say. I don't think it's entirely for any one reason. There are many people. I mean, there's not a universal decision that all villagers think alike. Some people would like to come down and live in a modern house. Some people would prefer to stay on the mountain. So there is difference of opinion among the Wulong residents. Some people are getting compensation to move. Some people are getting no compensation to move. So there are inconsistencies depending upon if the government is utilizing the land where a villager happens to be used for a reconstruction project, they're getting a sufficient amount of compensation. If they happen to be in a community where the government's requesting them to move down to a village but the government isn't rebuilding on that site, they're getting no compensation or very minor compensation for their agricultural land. So I think the reason for the move and relocation is less about tourism and more about having the opportunity to return agricultural lands to habitat over time. And what we would believe would be a balanced approach is we would support that activity, but would have a transitional period where farmers would be able to essentially transition, farm their land and convert it and restore it back towards habitat with more of a diverse planting of species and not monoculture, so that many of the Wulong residents would like to continue agriculture. And so we would suggest that the agriculture or the tending of their garden should be a panda habitat. And that could take a 10 or 15 year period, and there could be training and employment for other economic development opportunities.
And then someone would compensate. How does this all, how does your model work? The government would compensate them for setting up the gardens and tending the gardens.
There's a number of existing programs in China that are called grain to green. After the summer 1998 floods, there was a large forest protection program in China where agricultural lands were converted back into the upper Yangtze watershed. They were turned back to forest. So there were certain subsidies given to farmers over a 5 to 7 year period. So that practice could occur. We have, as an NGO, the population that we're discussing is not very large. We might be talking about, just to put things to get more specific, we're probably talking about 200 families, and $1,000 a year is what these families need to make that transition. So we're talking about $200,000 US dollars a year. We're talking 1.5 million, say, Hong Kong dollars a year. And so when you look at relative budgets of the reconstruction work, these are quite infinitesimal. They're something that are within the means of our nonprofit to raise funds for over time. And we have some community development activities where we're going to be applying for a timber permit to harvest this larch, to process it into products that can be sold. So there's a number of ways to fund things, but the fundamental question is, will these people be allowed to retain use of their land for an extended period of time during a transition? And that's yet to be worked out.
Maybe we take one more question.
Yeah.
Oh, Carl?
I just wanted to know, is the Hong Kong government, is it able to influence these types of decisions vis-a-vis the negotiations with the villagers that don't want to move? Is there any way that the Hong Kong side can exert a sort of positive influence on that process? That's the first thing. And what happens if, I actually don't know how the negotiations are going, but say, for example, there are negotiations ongoing. If they do break down, is it possible that there might be a potential for social unrest? And how are the planners planning to deal with that possibility, if it exists?
Yeah, I'd answer the second part first. I don't want to have the sense that there's some tremendously explosive situation here. Surprisingly, you ask a Wulong villager, so what's going to happen? And they say, and they calmly smile at you and say, I don't know. And they're still smiling. They are remarkably positive and in a good sense, fatalistic. They sense something will be done, and they're not, and as I said, the one head of this village just simply said, we're not going to come down the mountain and stop farming until there's some job for us to do something. So I don't think anyone's compelling them. I don't think there's any force being used. I just think there is so much, I'll get to the Hong Kong government side, there is so much to be done in terms of major infrastructure that in terms of orders of priority or magnitude, this really hasn't yet been on the government agenda, or it really hasn't been sufficiently thought through. And for now, there's a light hand. The villages, I think, are going to be completed, but I don't know if they're going to be well utilized or fully occupied. They're compelling people to pay a price to move so that there's a subsidy. But the villagers aren't getting the house for free. They have to pay for it. Most of them don't have the money to pay. So it may end up being that many houses aren't paid for. And so there's lots of kind of disconnects. In terms of the Hong Kong government position and role in this, I've talked to the Development Bureau and suggested things they might do. And in respect and deference, in deference to them, it's very difficult that they don't want to enter into passing judgment on what is a Sichuan policy. So I think it's fair to say that the Development Bureau, which is the lead entity here in Hong Kong, views all of these housing issues as a Sichuan policy decision, and that they should remain uninvolved. I think for myself, I think that's an abdication. You know, I think that's, to me, not an acceptable position, but it's a politically astute position to sidestep the issue. I think a reasoned approach would be to provide a listening session. It's not that there's going to be a prescriptive statement by the Hong Kong side that says this is what we think should happen, but I think certainly the Hong Kong government has every opportunity to provide a forum, or at least a venue by which these issues could be considered and discussed, and then let them be settled. There are entities within Sichuan that know that these issues are not yet resolved and need to be addressed. So I don't think the Hong Kong government would be overextending themselves by saying, or at least asking the question, is there a way for us to help, you know, remedy these current contradictions? I think they could ask questions in a positive way, and I think the civil society here in Hong Kong could provide more than enough support. If you look at the tax base that's going to pay for all these enormous facilities, the amount of money involved here, $1,000 for a family, and there's only a couple hundred families that are being relocated, it's quite small. And again, this is supposed to be the showcase of China's finest, best example of harmonious development, and there is this disconnect. So I think it will get addressed.
I
think it will get addressed, but I think it's probably 6 months away or so. And I think one of the things that hopefully, one of the positive things that will happen is I'm hoping at least we are writing to the IUCN. I mean, the IUCN is going to be there on April 15th and 16th in Wulong, and presumably there are going to be some stakeholder meetings where villagers will be able to step forward and either air their grievances or share their thoughts. And so one way, whether the Hong Kong government comes forward, hopefully this review of heritage site status will be one way in which an external party can provide some credible evaluation on alternatives.
One of the things we've done in Hong Kong over the last few years is to, just very briefly,
yes,
is to tackle this in an oblique way. And until, for example, our group, the Central and Western Concern Group, started talking about heritage conservation in Central, the bureaucrats had never heard of things like the borough charter. These are the best practice conservation methods.
Right.
And I noticed you've got the China
ICOMOS,
yeah, which is the sort of standards that you need to, when you're going into these sort of places, you say, well, we've got best practice here, and they're enshrined in the ICOMOS, for example, the China ICOMOS, which is
the International Council of Monuments and Sites, that acronym. And so with World Heritage, you have either the designation of cultural heritage, which is looked after by ICOMOS, or this International Council of Monuments and Sites, or you have natural heritage. So they make that very, and the natural heritage is looked after by the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. So those are the two.
So my point is that the non-confrontational thing that happens in China and Hong Kong, the way to go around that is to challenge them on the international best practice.
Yes.
And that's what we've done very successfully with the conservation of many of the sites in Central. We've thrown them at them and said, look, you're not doing it right. Here's why.
Yeah, if you're Asia's lead city, why can't we at least reflect?
And these sort practice. Of things like the Borough Charter, people had never heard of them. And I think the public has never heard of these sort of treaties. And that's my suggestion,
Do. Well, we're hoping that the IUCN will provide that initial impetus for greater review.
Look, I know we all need to go back to work, but is there one last question from the floor, and then we'll
And I'm
we'll
happy.
Wind
I'm
it up.
Very happy. My afternoon is open. I'll stay here and visit, just with people individually.
one last question, very quickly, 1 minute.
Please. Just go ahead. No, I don't think so. I mean, there was at times maybe a deer or a goat, but certainly there's never an issue of panda poaching. I mean, that's beyond contemplation. First of all, one wouldn't find a panda to begin with, and if one did, there would be no way for a person to, unless they had a death wish, they wouldn't poach a panda. So, but yeah, I mean, it'd be an act of terrorism is what it would be.
I'd like to say thank you to Mark
and
to give him a president from the FCC.
Thank you very much.
Many thanks, Mark. Yes, if you want to have a quick talk to him
I'll be right
after
here.
The talk, please do. Yep. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks very much. Yes, thank you. Thank you.